Lola Lion Editions presents Memories, Dreams, Reflections by Carl Jung. Read for you by Michael York.
Prologue. My life is the story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation, and the personality, too, desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions and to experience itself as a whole. I cannot employ the language of science to trace this process of growth in myself, for I cannot experience myself as a scientific problem. Thus it is that I have now undertaken, in my 83rd year, to tell my personal myth. I can only make direct statements, only tell stories. Whether or not the stories are true is not the problem. The only question is whether what I tell is my fable, my truth. Life has always seemed to me like a plant that lives on its rhizome or root. Its true life is invisible, hidden in the rhizome. The part that appears above ground lasts only a single summer. Then it withers away, an ephemeral apparition. When we think of the unending growth and decay of life and civilizations, we cannot escape the impression of absolute nullity. Yet I have never lost a sense of something that lives and endures underneath the eternal flux. What we see is the blossom which passes. The rhizome remains. In the end, the only events in my life worth telling are those when the imperishable world erupted into this transitory one. That is why I speak chiefly of inner experiences, amongst which I include my dreams and visions. These form the prima materia of my scientific work. They were the fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized. First years. When I was 6 months old, my parents moved from Kessville on Lake Constance to Laufen, the castle and vicarage above the falls of the Rhine. This was in 1875. My memories begin with my second or third year. I recall the vicarage, the garden, the laundry house, the church, the castle, the falls, the small castle of Wurt, and the sexton's farm. These are nothing but islands of memory afloat in a sea of vagueness, each by itself, apparently with no connection between them. One memory comes up, which is perhaps the earliest of my life, and is indeed only a rather hazy impression. I am lying in a pram, in the shadow of a tree. It is a fine, warm summer day, the sky blue, and golden sunlight darting through the green leaves. The hood of the pram has been left up. I have just awakened to the glorious beauty of the day, and have a sense of indescribable well-being. I see the sun glittering through the leaves and blossoms of the bushes. Everything is wholly wonderful, colorful, and splendid. Yet another image. I am restive, feverish, unable to sleep. My father carries me in his arms, paces up and down, singing his old student songs. To this day I can remember my father's voice singing over me in the stillness of the night. I was suffering, so my mother told me afterward, from general eczema. Dim intimations of trouble in my parents' marriage hovered around me. My illness, in 1878, must have been connected with a temporary separation of my parents. My mother spent several months in a hospital in Basel, and presumably her illness had something to do with the difficulty in the marriage. An aunt of mine, who was a spinster and some 20 years older than my mother, took care of me. I was deeply troubled by my mother's being away. From then on, I always felt mistrustful when the word love was spoken. The feeling I associated with woman was for a long time that of innate unreliability. father, on the other hand, meant reliability and powerlessness. That is the handicap I started off with. Later, these early impressions were revised. I have trusted men, friends, and been disappointed by them. And I have mistrusted women, and was not disappointed. These are my outward memories. What follows now are more powerful, indeed overwhelming images, some of which I recall only dimly. At about the same time, I had the earliest dream I can remember, a dream which was to preoccupy me all my life. I was then between 3 and 4 years old. The vicarage stood quite alone near Laufen Castle, and there was a big meadow stretching back from the sexton's farm. In the dream, I was in this meadow. Suddenly I discovered a dark, rectangular, stone-lined hole in the ground. I had never seen it before. I ran forward curiously and peered down into it. Then I saw a stone stairway leading down. Hesitantly and fearfully, I descended. At the bottom was a doorway with a round arch closed off by a green curtain. It was a big, heavy curtain of material like brocade, and it looked very sumptuous. Curious to see what might be hidden behind, I pushed it aside. I saw before me in the dim light a rectangular chamber about 30 feet long. The ceiling was arched and of hewn stone. The floor was laid with flagstones, and in the center a red carpet ran from the entrance to a low platform. On this platform stood a wonderfully rich golden throne. I am not certain, but perhaps a red cushion lay on the seat. It was a magnificent throne, a real king's throne in a fairy tale. Something was standing on it, which I thought at first was a tree trunk 12 to 15 feet high and about 1.5 to 2 feet thick. It was a huge thing, reaching almost to the ceiling. But it was of a curious composition. It was made of skin and naked flesh, and on top there was something like a rounded head with no face and no hair. On the very top of the head was a single eye, gazing motionlessly upward. It was fairly light in the room, although there were no windows and no apparent source of light. Above the head, however, was an aura of brightness. The thing did not move, yet I had the feeling that it might at any moment crawl off the throne like a worm and creep toward me. I was paralyzed with terror. At that moment I heard from outside and above me my mother's voice. She called out, "Yes, just look at him. That is the man-eater." That intensified my terror still more, and I awoke, sweating and scared to death. For many nights afterward, I was afraid to go to sleep because I feared I might have another dream like that one. This dream haunted me for years. Only much later did I realize that what I had seen was a phallus. And it was decades before I understood that it was a ritual phallus. The abstract significance of the phallus is shown by the fact that it was enthroned by itself. The hole in the meadow probably represented a grave. The grave itself was an underground temple whose green curtain symbolized the meadow. In other words, the mystery of earth with her covering of green vegetation. The carpet was blood red. What about the vault? Perhaps I had been to the Mühnhill, the citadel of Schaffhausen. This is not likely, since no one would take a 3-year-old child up there, so it cannot be a memory trace. Equally, I do not know where the anatomically correct phallus can have come from. The interpretation of the urethral orifice as an eye, with a source of light apparently above it, points to the etymology of the phallus, meaning shining or bright. Through this childhood dream, I was initiated into the secrets of the earth. What happened then was a kind of burial in the earth, and many years were to pass before I came out again. Today I know that it happened in order to bring the greatest possible amount of light into the darkness. It was an initiation into the realm of darkness. My intellectual life had its unconscious beginnings at that time. Soon after I was 6, my father began giving me Latin lessons, and I also went to school. I did not mind school. It was easy for me, since I was always ahead of the others and had learned to read before I went there. However, I remember a time when I could not read, but pestered my mother to read aloud to me out of the Orbis Pictus, an old, richly illustrated children's book, which contained an account of exotic religions, especially that of the Hindus. There were illustrations of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, which I found an inexhaustible source of interest. My mother later told me that I always returned to these pictures. Whenever I did so, I had an obscure feeling of their affinity with my original revelation, which I never spoke of to anyone. It was a secret I must never betray. Indirectly, my mother confirmed this feeling, for the faint tone of contempt with which she spoke of heathens did not escape me. I knew that she would reject my revelation with horror, and I did not want to expose myself to any such injury. This unchildlike behavior was connected, on the one hand, with an intense sensitivity and vulnerability, and on the other hand, and this especially, with the loneliness of my early youth. My sister was born 9 years after me, so I played alone and in my own way. Unfortunately, I cannot remember what I played. I recall only that I did not want to be disturbed. One of my reasons for liking school was that there I found at last the playmates I had lacked for so long. At school, I also discovered something else. But before I go into this, I should first mention that the nocturnal atmosphere had begun to thicken. All sorts of things were happening at night, things incomprehensible and alarming. My parents were sleeping apart. I slept in my father's room. From the door to my mother's room came frightening influences. At night, mother was strange and mysterious. One night, I saw coming from her door a faintly luminous, indefinite figure whose head detached itself from the neck and floated along in front of it, in the air, like a little moon. Immediately, another head was produced and again detached itself. This process was repeated 6 or 7 times. I had anxiety dreams of things that were now small, now large. For instance, I saw a tiny ball at a great distance. Gradually it approached, growing steadily into a monstrous and suffocating object. Or I saw telegraph wires with birds sitting on them, and the wires grew thicker, and my fear greater, until the terror woke me. Although these dreams were overtures to the physiological changes of puberty, they had in their turn a prelude which occurred about my 7th year. At that time I was sick with pseudo-croup, accompanied by choking fits. One night, during an attack, I stood at the foot of the bed, my head bent back over the bed rail, while my father held me under the arm. Above me, I saw a glowing blue circle about the size of the full moon, and inside it moved golden figures, which I thought were angels. This vision was repeated, and each time it allayed my fears of suffocation. But the suffocation returned in the anxiety dreams. I see in this a psychogenic factor. The atmosphere of the house was beginning to be unbreathable. I had in those days a yellow varnished pencil case, of the kind commonly used by primary school pupils, with a little lock and the customary ruler. At the end of this ruler, I now carved a little mannequin, about 2 inches long, with frock coat, top hat, and shiny black boots. I colored him black with ink, sawed him off the ruler, and put him in the pencil case, where I made him a little bed. I even made a coat for him out of a bit of wool. In the case, I also placed a smooth, oblong, blackish stone from the Rhine, which I had painted with watercolors to look as though it were divided into an upper and lower half, and had long carried around in my trouser pocket. This was his stone. All this was a great secret. I took the case to the attic at the top of the house and hid it with great satisfaction on one of the beams under the roof, for no one must ever see it. I knew that not a soul would ever find it there. No one could discover my secret and destroy it. I felt safe, and the tormenting sense of being at odds with myself was gone. In all difficult situations, whenever I had done something wrong or my feelings had been hurt, or when my father's irritability or my mother's invalidism oppressed me, I thought of my carefully bedded down and wrapped up mannequin and his smooth, prettily colored stone. From time to time, often at intervals of weeks, I secretly stole up to the attic when I could be certain that no one would see me. Then I clambered up on the beam, opened the case, and looked at my mannequin and his stone. Each time I did this, I placed in the case a little scroll of paper on which I had previously written something during school hours in a secret language of my own invention. The addition of a new scroll always had the character of a solemn ceremonial act. Unfortunately, I cannot remember what I wanted to communicate to the mannequin. I only know that my letters constituted a kind of library for him. I fancy, though I cannot be certain, that they may have consisted of sayings that particularly pleased me. The meanings of these actions, or how I might explain them, never worried me. I contented myself with the feeling of newly won security, and was satisfied to possess something that no one knew and no one could get at. It was an inviolable secret, which must never be betrayed, for the safety of my life depended on it. Why that was so, I did not ask myself. It was simply so. This possession of a secret had a very powerful formative influence on my character. I consider it the essential factor of my boyhood. Similarly, I never told anyone about the dream of the phallus. The little wooden figure with the stone was a first attempt, still unconscious and childish, to give shape to the secret. I was always absorbed by it and had the feeling I ought to fathom it, and yet I did not know what it was I was trying to express. I always hoped I might be able to find something, perhaps in nature, that would give me the clue and show me where or what the secret was. At that time my interest in plants, animals, and stones grew. I was constantly on the lookout for something mysterious. Consciously, I was religious in the Christian sense, though always with the reservation, "But it is not so certain as all that," or "What about that thing under the ground?" And when religious teachings were pumped into me and I was told, "This is beautiful and this is good," I would think to myself, "Yes, but there is something else, something very secret that people don't know about." The episode with the carved mannequin formed the climax and conclusion of my childhood. It lasted about a year. Thereafter, I completely forgot the whole affair until I was 35. Then, this fragment of memory rose up again from the mists of childhood with pristine clarity. While I was engaged on the preliminary studies for my book, Symbols and Transformation, I read about the cache of soul stones near Alzheim and the Australian Turingus. I suddenly discovered that I had a quite definite image of such a stone, though I had never seen any reproductions. It was oblong, blackish, and painted into an upper and lower half. This image was joined by that of the pencil box and the mannequin. The mannequin was a little cloaked god of the ancient world, a telesphorus, such as stands on the monument of Asclepios, and reads to him from a scroll. Along with this recollection, there came to me, for the first time, the conviction that there are archaic psychic components which have entered the individual psyche without any direct line of tradition. School years. One day in the early summer of 1887, when I was 12 years old, I was standing in the cathedral square, waiting for a classmate who went home by the same route as myself. It was 12 o'clock, and the morning classes were over. Suddenly, another boy gave me a shove that knocked me off my feet. I fell, striking my head against the curbstone so hard that I almost lost consciousness. At the moment I felt the blow, the thought flashed through my mind, "Now you won't have to go to school any more." I was only half unconscious, but I remained lying there a few moments longer than was strictly necessary, chiefly in order to avenge myself on my assailant. Then people picked me up and took me to a house nearby, where two elderly spinster aunts lived. From then on, I began to have fainting spells whenever I had to return to school, and whenever my parents set me to doing my homework. For more than 6 months, I stayed away from school, and for me, that was a picnic. I was free, could dream for hours, be anywhere I liked, in the woods or by the water, or draw. Above all, I was able to plunge into the world of the mysterious. To that realm belonged trees, a pool, a swamp, stones and animals, and my father's library. But I was growing more and more away from the world, and had all the while faint pangs of conscience. I frittered away my time with loafing, collecting, reading, and playing, but I did not feel any happier for it. I had the obscure feeling that I was fleeing from myself. I forgot completely how all this had come about, but I pitied my parents' worries. They consulted various doctors, who scratched their heads and packed me off to spend the holidays with relatives in Winterthur. This city had a railroad station that proved a source of endless delight to me. But when I returned home, everything was as before. One doctor thought I had epilepsy. I knew what epileptic fits were like, and I inwardly laughed at such nonsense. My parents became more worried than ever. Then one day, a friend called on my father. They were sitting in the garden, and I hid behind a shrub, for I was possessed of an insatiable curiosity. I heard the visitor saying to my father, "And how is your son?" "Ah, that's a sad business," my father replied. "The doctors no longer know what is wrong with him. They think it may be epilepsy. It would be dreadful if he were incurable. I have lost what little I had, and what will become of the boy if he cannot earn his own living?" I was thunderstruck. This was the collision with reality. "Why, then I must get to work," I thought suddenly. From that moment on, I became a serious child. I crept away, went to my father's study, took out my Latin grammar, and began to cram with intense concentration. After 10 minutes of this, I had the finest of fainting fits. I almost fell off the chair, but after a few minutes I felt better and went on working. "Devil take it, I'm not going to faint," I told myself, and persisted in my purpose. This time it took about 15 minutes before the second attack came. That, too, passed like the first. "And now you must really get to work," I told myself. I stuck it out, and after an hour came the third attack. Still I did not give up, and worked for another hour, until I had the feeling that I had overcome the attacks. Suddenly, I felt better than I had in all the months before. And in fact the attacks did not recur. From that day on, I worked over my grammar and other school books every day. That was when I learned what a neurosis is. Gradually, the recollection of how it had all come about returned to me, and I saw clearly that I myself had arranged this whole disgraceful situation. I had a feeling of rage against myself, and at the same time, was ashamed of myself. For I knew that I had wronged myself and made a fool of myself in my own eyes. Nobody else was to blame. I was the cursed renegade. What led me astray during the crisis was my passion for being alone, my delight in solitude. Nature seemed to me full of wonders, and I wanted to steep myself in them. Every stone, every plant, every single thing seemed alive and indescribably marvelous. I immersed myself in nature, crawled, as it were, into the very essence of nature, and away from the whole human world. One fine summer day, I came out of school at noon and went to the cathedral square. The sky was gloriously blue, the day one of radiant sunshine. The roof of the cathedral glittered, the sun sparkling from the new brightly glazed tiles. I was overwhelmed by the beauty of the sight and thought, the world is beautiful and the church is beautiful, and God made all this and sits above it far away in the blue sky on a golden throne and... Here came a great hole in my thoughts and a choking sensation. I felt numbed and knew only, don't go on thinking now. Something terrible is coming, something I do not want to think, something I dare not even approach. Why not? Because I would be committing the most frightful of sins. What is the most terrible sin? Murder? No, it can't be that. The most terrible sin is the sin against the Holy Ghost, which cannot be forgiven. Anyone who commits that sin is damned to hell for all eternity. That would be very sad for my parents if their only son, to whom they are so attached, should be doomed to eternal damnation. I cannot do that to my parents. All I need do is not go on thinking. That was easier said than done. On my long walk home, I tried to think all sorts of other things, but I found my thoughts returning again and again to the beautiful cathedral which I loved so much, and to God sitting on the throne, and then my thoughts would fly off again as if they had received a powerful electric shock. I reached home in a pretty worked-up state. My mother noticed that something was wrong and asked, "What is the matter with you? Has something happened at school?" I did have the thought that it might help me to confess to my mother the real reason for my turmoil. But to do so, I would have to do the very thing that seemed impossible, think my thought right to the end. That night I slept badly. Again and again the forbidden thought, which I did not yet know, tried to break out, and I struggled desperately to fend it off. The next 2 days were sheer torture, and my mother was convinced that I was ill. But I resisted the temptation to confess, aided by the thought that it would cause my parents intense sorrow. On the third night, however, the torment became so unbearable that I no longer knew what to do. I awoke from a restless sleep, just in time to catch myself thinking again about the cathedral and God. I had almost continued the thought. Sweating with fear, I sat up in bed to shake off sleep. Now it is coming. Now it's serious. I must think. It must be thought out beforehand. Why should I think something I don't know and don't want to know? Where does this terrible will come from? And why should I be the one to be subjected to it? I haven't done this or wanted this. It has come on me like a bad dream. Where do such things come from? This has happened to me without my doing. Why? After all, I didn't create myself. I came into this world the way God made me. That is, the way I was shaped by my parents. Or can it have been that my parents wanted something of this sort? But my good parents would never have had any thoughts like that. Nothing so atrocious would ever have occurred to them. I found this idea utterly absurd. Then I thought of my grandparents, whom I knew only from their portraits. They looked benevolent and dignified enough to repulse any idea that they might possibly be to blame. I mentally ran through the long procession of unknown ancestors until finally I arrived at Adam and Eve. And with them came the decisive thought. Adam and Eve were the first people. They had no parents, but they were created directly by God, who intentionally made them as they were. They had no choice but to be exactly the way God had created them. Therefore, they did not know how they could possibly be different. They were perfect creatures of God, for He creates only perfection. And yet, they committed the first sin by doing what God did not want them to do. How was that possible? They could not have done it if God had not placed in them the possibility of doing it. Therefore, it was God's intention that they should sin. This thought liberated me instantly from my worst torment, since I now knew that God Himself had placed me in this situation. At first, I did not know whether He intended me to commit my sin or not. What does God want? To act or not to act? I must find out what God wants with me, and I must find out right away. My broken sleep and my spiritual distress had worn me out to such a point that fending off the thought was tying me into unbearable knots. This could not go on. At the same time, I could not yield before I understood what God's will was and what He intended, for I was now certain that He was the author of this desperate problem. I knew, beyond a doubt, that I would ultimately be compelled to break down, to give way. But I did not want it to happen without my understanding it, since the salvation of my eternal soul was at stake. God knows that I cannot resist much longer, and He does not help me, although I am on the point of having to commit the unforgivable sin. In His omnipotence, He could easily lift this compulsion from me, but evidently He is not going to. Can it be that He wishes to test my obedience by imposing on me the unusual task of doing something against my own moral judgment and against His own commandment, something I am resisting with all my strength because I fear eternal damnation? Is it possible that God wishes to see whether I am capable of obeying His will, even though my faith and my reason raise before me the specters of death and hell? That might really be the answer. Obviously, God also desires me to show courage, I thought. If that is so, and I go through with it, then He will give me His grace and illumination. I gathered all my courage, as though I were about to leap forthwith into hell fire. And let the thought come. I saw before me the cathedral, the blue sky. God sits on His golden throne, high above the world, and under the throne an enormous turd falls upon the sparkling new roof, shatters it, and breaks the walls of the cathedral asunder. So that was it. I felt an enormous and indescribable relief. Instead of the expected damnation, grace had come upon me, and with it an unutterable bliss, such as I had never known. I wept for happiness and gratitude. The wisdom and goodness of God had been revealed to me now that I had yielded to His inexorable command. That was what my father had not understood, I thought. He had failed to experience the will of God, had opposed it for the best reasons and out of the deepest faith. And that is why he had never experienced the miracle of grace, which heals all and makes all comprehensible. He did not know the immediate living God who stands omnipotent and free above His Bible and His church, who calls upon man to partake of his freedom, and can force him to renounce his own views and convictions in order to fulfill without reserve the command of God. In His trial of human courage, God refuses to abide by traditions, no matter how sacred. In His omnipotence, He will see to it that nothing really evil comes of such tests of courage. If one fulfills the will of God, one can be sure of going the right way. It was obedience which brought me grace. And after that experience, I knew what God's grace was. One must be utterly abandoned to God. Nothing matters but fulfilling His will. Otherwise, all is folly and meaninglessness. With the experience of God and the cathedral, I at last had something tangible that was part of the great secret. As if I had always talked of stones falling from heaven, and now had one in my pocket. But actually, it was a shaming experience. I had fallen into something bad, something evil and sinister, though at the same time, it was a kind of distinction. Sometimes I had an overwhelming urge to speak, not about that, but only to hint that there were some curious things about me which no one knew of. I wanted to find out whether other people had undergone similar experiences. I never succeeded in discovering so much as a trace of them in others. As a result, I had the feeling that I was either outlawed or elect, accursed or blessed. Student years. I looked forward with longing to the end of my school days. Then I would go to the university and study. Natural science, of course. Then I would know something real. But no sooner had I made myself this promise than my doubts began. Was not my bent rather toward history and philosophy? Then again, I was intensely interested in everything Egyptian and Babylonian, and would have liked best to be an archaeologist. But I had no money to study anywhere except in Basel, and in Basel there was no teacher for this subject. So this plan very soon came to an end. For a long time, I could not make up my mind, and constantly postponed the decision. My father was very worried. He said once, "The boy is interested in everything imaginable, and he does not know what he wants." I could only admit that he was right. As matriculation approached, and we had to decide what faculty to register for, I abruptly decided on science. But I left my schoolfellows in doubt as to whether I intended to go in definitely for science or the humanities. This apparently sudden decision had a background of its own. Some weeks previously, I had two dreams. In the first dream, I was in a dark wood that stretched along the Rhine. I came to a little hill, a burial mound, and began to dig. After a while I turned up, to my astonishment, some bones of prehistoric animals. This interested me enormously, and at that moment I knew I must get to know nature, the world in which we live, and the things around us. Then came a second dream. Again I was in a wood. It was threaded with watercourses, and in the darkest place I saw a circular pool surrounded by dense undergrowth. Half immersed in the water lay the strangest and most wonderful creature, a round animal shimmering in opalescent hues and consisting of innumerable little cells or of organs shaped like tentacles. It was a giant radiolarian, measuring about 3 feet across. It seemed to me indescribably wonderful that this magnificent creature should be lying there undisturbed, in the hidden place, in the clear, deep water. It aroused in me an intense desire for knowledge, so that I awoke with a beating heart. These two dreams decided me overwhelmingly in favor of science, and removed all my doubts. It became clear to me that I was living in a time and a place where a person had to earn his living. To do so, one had to be this or that, and it made a deep impression on me that all my schoolfellows were imbued with this necessity and thought about nothing else. I felt I was in some way odd. I saw I would have to settle down and think the matter through. If I took up zoology, for instance, I could be only a schoolmaster, or at best, an employee in a zoological garden. There was no future in that, even if one's demands were modest, though I would certainly have preferred working in a zoo to the life of a schoolteacher. In this blind alley, the inspiration suddenly came to me that I could study medicine. I told myself that the study of medicine, at least, began with scientific subjects. To that extent, I would be doing what I wanted. Moreover, the field of medicine was so broad that there was always the possibility of specializing later. I had definitely opted for science, and the only question was, how? I had to earn my living, and as I had no money, I could not attend a university abroad and obtain the kind of training that would give me hopes of a scientific career. At best, I could become only a dilettante in science. nor, since I possessed a personality that made me disliked by many of my schoolfellows and of the people who counted, that is, the teachers, was there any hope of finding a patron who would support my wish. When, therefore, I finally decided on medicine, it was with a rather disagreeable feeling that it was not a good thing to start life with such a compromise. Nevertheless, I felt considerably relieved now that this irrevocable decision had been made. Where was the money to come from? My father could raise only part of it. He applied to the University of Basel for a stipend for me, and to my shame, it was granted. I was ashamed, not so much because our poverty was laid bare for all the world to see, but because I had secretly been convinced that all the top people, the people who counted, were ill-disposed toward me. I'd never expected any such kindness from them. I had obviously profited by the reputation of my father, who was a good and uncomplicated person. Yet I felt myself totally different from him. I had, in fact, two different conceptions of myself. Through number one's eyes, I saw myself as a rather disagreeable and moderately gifted young man with vaulting ambitions, an undisciplined temperament, and dubious manners, alternating between naive enthusiasm and fits of childish disappointment, in his innermost essence a hermit and obscurantist. On the other hand, number two regarded number one as a difficult and thankless moral task, a lesson that had to be got through somehow, complicated by a variety of faults such as spells of laziness, despondency, depression, inept enthusiasm for ideas and things that nobody valued, liable to imaginary friendships, limited, prejudiced, stupid, with a lack of understanding for other people, vague and confused in philosophical matters, neither an honest Christian nor anything else. Number two had no definable character at all. He was a vita per acta, born, living, dead, everything in one, a total vision of life. Though pitilessly clear about himself, he was unable to express himself through the dense, dark medium of number one, though he longed to do so. Number two felt that any conceivable expression of himself would be like a stone thrown over the edge of the world, dropping soundlessly into infinite night. But in him, light reigned, as in the spacious halls of a royal palace, whose high casements open upon a landscape flooded with sunlight. Here were meaning and historical continuity, in strong contrast to the incoherent fortuitousness of number one's life, which had no real points of contact with its environment. Number two, on the other hand, felt himself in secret accord with the Middle Ages, as personified by Faust, with the legacy of a past which had obviously stirred Goethe to the depths. For Goethe, too, therefore, and this was my great consolation, number two was a reality. Faust was the living equivalent of number two, and I was convinced that he was the answer which Goethe had given to his times. This insight was not only comforting to me, it also gave me an increased feeling of inner security and a sense of belonging to the human community. I was no longer isolated and a mere curiosity, a sport of cruel nature. About this time, I had a dream which both frightened me and encouraged me. It was night in some unknown place, and I was making slow and painful headway against a mighty wind. Dense fog was flying along everywhere. I had my hands cupped around a tiny light, which threatened to go out at any moment. Everything depended on my keeping this little light alive. Suddenly I had the feeling that something was coming up behind me. I looked back and saw a gigantic black figure following me. But at the same moment I was conscious, in spite of my terror, that I must keep my little light going through the night and wind, regardless of the dangers. When I awoke, I realized at once that the figure was my own shadow on the swirling mists, brought into being by the little light I was carrying. I knew, too, that this little light was my consciousness, the only light I have. My own understanding is the sole treasure I possess, and the greatest. This dream was a great illumination for me. Now I knew that number one was the bearer of the light, and that number two followed him like a shadow. My task was to shield the light and not look back at the Vita Paracta. This was evidently a forbidden realm of light of a different sort. I must go forward against the storm, which sought to thrust me back into the immeasurable darkness of a world where one is aware of nothing except the surfaces of things in the background. The storm pushing against me was time, ceaselessly flowing into the past, which just as ceaselessly dogs our heels. My view of the world spun around another 90 degrees. I recognized clearly that my path led irrevocably outward into the limitations and darkness of three-dimensionality. It seemed to me that Adam must once have left paradise in this manner. Eden had become a spectre for him, and light was where a stony field had to be tilled in the sweat of his brow. At any rate, a schism had taken place between me and number two, with the result that I was assigned to number one and was separated from number two in the same degree, who thereby acquired, as it were, an autonomous personality. I did not connect this with the idea of any definite individuality, although with my rustic origins this possibility would not have seemed strange to me. In the country, people believe in these things according to the circumstances. They are and they are not. The only distinct feature about this spirit was his historical character, his extension in time, or rather, his timelessness. Of course, I did not tell myself this in so many words, nor did I form any conception of his spatial existence. He played the role of a factor in the background of my number one existence, never clearly defined, but yet definitely present. During the years 1892 to 1894, I had a number of rather vehement discussions with my father. My mother avoided everything that might excite him and refused to engage in disputes. I would remain passive during his outbursts of rage, but when he seemed to be in a more accessible mood, I sometimes tried to strike up a conversation with him, hoping to learn something about his inner thoughts and his understanding of himself. It was clear to me that something quite specific was tormenting him, and I suspected that it had to do with his faith. This, it seemed to me, was bound to be the case if the necessary experience had not come to him. From my attempts at discussion, I learned, in fact, that something of the sort was amiss, for all my questions were met with the same old lifeless theological answers, or with a resigned shrug which aroused the spirit of contradiction in me. I could not understand why he did not seize on these opportunities pugnaciously and come to terms with his situation. He had to quarrel with somebody, so he did it with his family and himself. Why didn't he do it with God, the dark author of all created things, who alone was responsible for the sufferings of the world? God would assuredly have sent him by way of an answer one of those magical, infinitely profound dreams which he had sent to me without being asked, and which had sealed my fate. Theology had alienated my father and me from one another. I had a dim premonition that he was inescapably succumbing to his fate. He was lonely, and had no friend to talk with. At least I knew no one among our acquaintances whom I would have trusted to say the saving word. Once I heard him praying. He struggled desperately to keep his faith. I was shaken and outraged at once, because I saw how hopelessly he was entrapped by the church and its theological thinking. They had blocked all avenues by which he might have reached God directly, and then faithlessly abandoned him. The arch sin of faith, it seemed to me, was that it forestalled experience. His depressive moods increased, and so did his hypochondria. For a number of years he had complained of all sorts of abdominal symptoms, though his doctor had been unable to find anything definite wrong with him. Now he complained of the sensation of having stones in the abdomen. For a long time we did not take this seriously, but at last the doctor became suspicious. Soon afterward his condition deteriorated. In late autumn of 1895 he became bedridden, and early in 1896 he died. I had come home after lectures and asked how he was. "Oh, still the same. He's very weak," my mother said. He whispered something to her, which she repeated to me, warning me with her eyes of his delirious condition. "He wants to know whether you have passed the state examination." I saw that I must lie. "Yes, it went very well." He sighed with relief and closed his eyes. A little later I went in to see him again. He was alone. My mother was doing something in the adjoining room. There was a rattling in his throat, and I could see that he was in the death agony. I stood by his bed, fascinated. I had never seen anyone die before. Suddenly, he stopped breathing. I waited, and waited for the next breath. It did not come. Then I remembered my mother and went into the next room, where she sat by the window, knitting. "He is dying," I said. She came with me to the bed and saw that he was dead. She said, as if in wonderment, "How quickly it has all passed." The following days were gloomy and painful, and little of them has remained in my memory. Once my mother spoke to me or to the surrounding air and remarked, "He died in time for you," which appeared to mean you did not understand each other and he might have become a hindrance to you. The words "for you" hit me terribly hard, and I felt that a bit of the old days had come irrevocably to an end. At the same time, a bit of manliness and freedom awoke in me. After my father's death, I moved into his room and took his place inside the family. For instance, I had to hand out the housekeeping money to my mother every week because she was unable to economize and could not manage money. 6 weeks after his death, my father appeared to me in a dream. Suddenly he stood before me and said that he was coming back from his holiday. He had made a good recovery and was now coming home. I thought he would be annoyed with me for having moved into his room, but not a bit of it. Nevertheless, I felt ashamed because I had imagined he was dead. 2 days later, the dream was repeated. Later, I kept asking myself, what does it mean that my father returns in dreams, that he seems so real? It was an unforgettable experience, and it forced me for the first time to think about life after death. In 1898, I began to think more seriously about my career as a medical man. I soon came to the conclusion that I would have to specialize. The choice seemed to lie between surgery and internal medicine. Though I had attended psychiatric lectures and clinics, the current instructor in psychiatry was not exactly stimulating, and this was not calculated to prepossess me in favor of psychiatry. In preparing myself for the state examination, therefore, the textbook on psychiatry by Krafft Ebing was the last I attacked. I expected nothing of it, and I still remember that as I opened the book, the thought came to me, well, now let's see what a psychiatrist has to say for himself. By way of excuse for this high and mighty attitude, I must make it clear that in the medical world at that time, psychiatry was quite generally held in contempt. No one really knew anything about it, and there was no psychology which regarded man as a whole and included his pathological variations in the total picture. The director was locked up in the same institution with his patients, and the institution was equally cut off, isolated on the outskirts of the city like an ancient lazaret with its lepers. Beginning with the preface, I read, "It is probably due to the peculiarity of the subject and its incomplete state of development that psychiatric textbooks are stamped with a more or less subjective character. A few lines further on, the author called the psychoses diseases of the personality. My heart suddenly began to pound. I had to stand up and draw a deep breath. My excitement was intense, for it had become clear to me in a flash of illumination that for me the only possible goal was psychiatry. Here alone the two currents of my interest could flow together and in a united stream dig their own bed. Here was the empirical field common to biological and spiritual facts, which I had everywhere sought and nowhere found. Here at last was the place where the collision of nature and spirit became a reality. My violent reaction set in when Krafft-Ebing spoke of the subjective character of psychiatric textbooks. So I thought the textbook is in part the subjective confession of the author. With his specific prejudice, with the totality of his being, he stands behind the objectivity of his experiences and responds to the disease of the personality with the whole of his own personality. The decision was taken. When I informed my teacher in internal medicine of my intention, I could read in his face his amazement and disappointment. My old wound, the feeling of being an outsider and of alienating others, began to ache again. But now I understood why. No one, not even myself, had ever imagined I could become interested in this obscure bypath. My friends were astounded and put out, thinking me a fool for throwing up the enviable chance of a sensible career in internal medicine, which dangled so temptingly before my nose, in favor of this psychiatric nonsense. On December 10th, 1900, I took up my post as assistant at Burgholzli Mental Hospital, Zurich. When I came to that city, I felt the difference at once. Zurich relates to the world not by the intellect, but by commerce. Yet here the air was free, and I had always valued that. Here you were not weighed down by the brown fog of the centuries, even though one missed the rich background of culture.